Struggling to move your nonprofit forward? You've come to the right place. Welcome to the Nonprofit Architect, where we are giving you the actionable steps you need to launch and grow your nonprofit organization. Now, here's your host, Travis Johnson.
Hey, welcome back to the show. I'm here today with Otis McGregor. He's the founder of Tribe and Purpose, retired Lieutenant Colonel and Green Beret. Otis, how the heck are you doing?
Hey, man, I am doing great, and I'm just happy to chat with you. You know that.
We've probably known each other for right at a year.
It's our one-year anniversary.
It's our one-year anniversary. I got you a gift. You're a guest on my show.
Woo! I got you a piece of paper because it's, that's the anniversary. There's your piece of paper.
Oh, is that year one is paper?
Yeah, I think so. But I'll say it is, whether it is or not. Sounds good.
If it's not true, we're going to make it true. We're going to have the Tribe and Purpose when your anniversary is going to be paper. So write that down, mark that on your calendars. We've actually spent quite a bit of time together. We've done like 24 Zoom calls. We've had a whole event that we were in Texas at a ranch for a week together, which was a whole lot of fun.
Yes, it was.
Tell us a little bit about your background, Otis, and about Tribe and Purpose.
Yeah, well, I grew up in Texas, which made the trip to the ranch in Texas even more fun. I was enlisted in the Army while I was a cadet, driving a tank that was 5 years older than me, and then shifted over to doing the ground pounder stuff, and then got commissioned as an engineer, and went to Alaska, which was, that's a whole nother adventure in itself, and then I raised my hand to volunteer to be a Green Beret and did that for the rest of my career. And I always love to tell this part of the story. The fact that I had such a clear idea of what I wanted to be in the Army, 20 years and Lieutenant Colonel, 05 Lieutenant Colonel, I knew specifically. At like 16 years, I pinned on Lieutenant Colonel, got to the 25 years active because of the guard time. So 25 years, got to that mark and said, okay, well, that's enough. I'm tired of moving. Season of life's over. Now I get a job. And that was literally the only plan I had getting out of the Army was I'll get a job. That's about dumb. It's hard to believe when you think of how clear I was at like 19 years old, exactly what I wanted to accomplish in my military career. And then after the Army, I was like, thank you very much. Time to get a job. And 7 years of what I call wandering the job desert, bouncing from job to job, company to company, every one of them, I thought, man, this is the one. This is what I'm going to do for the next 20 years. 90 days is about all I made it before I started hating what I was doing. And the longest I lasted with a company was 18 months before I quit. Those were some long days and some hard lessons that I finally learned. And that's what led me to starting Tribe and Purpose. I finally figured it all out. So yeah. And Tribe and Purpose, it's about finding clarity and resolve in your purpose and building a tribe around it. So you have more success in life.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. I did a similar track to you, did the enlisted time and then got commissioned. I waited a little bit longer in my enlisted journey before I got commissioned, so I didn't quite hit 05. I got selected for 04 and then had to write the hardest letter of my life, declining that promotion. 04 in the Navy's lieutenant commander and other services would be considered field grade when you hit that next level. I couldn't do it. I couldn't do it anymore. The more I learned about business and nonprofits and podcasting and all this different stuff, I'm like, the way I'm thinking and my trajectory of where I'm going is just no longer suits the military, especially being in the strategic world, because there's not a lot of room for growth and development. It's pretty much standardized rules set by STRATCOM. So there's not a lot of, hey, we're going to try this out. It's pretty much, this is what we're doing. This is the way we have to do it because this is the way it's dictated to us. So I no longer had the ability to grow the way I wanted to. And then when I hit the 20, yeah, punched out at 22, my commissioning program said I had to do extra time. So I did the extra time and got out essentially at my earliest opportunity. But you said some things in your background that I wanted to pull to to pull out more of. You said you did 7 years wandering the job desert. You did some nonprofit time. Fortunately for me, I found out that I immediately upon leaving and had been growing this podcast before I got out, knew that I had wanted nothing to do with corporate work at all. And the vast majority of nonprofits I talk to are really stuck in this scarcity mode and mindset. But you said you were a ground pounder. Now, I'm in aviation. Ground pounder for me means that you're an airplane mechanic. Is that what ground pounder means for you?
No, it means I walk there by pounding the ground with my boots. Generally speaking, the pounding was much louder and heavier because of all the weight in the rucksack. You know, 100 pounds of lightweight gear, you know, is still 100 pounds. Do that math. Remember that physics class when they said, you know, what weighs more, 100 pounds of feathers or 100 pounds of lead? You know, guess what?
100 pounds of feathers is still 100 pounds, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, that's what it was. I walked. I would jump out of the airplane or get dropped off somewhere and walk there is pretty much what that meant. Yeah.
That doesn't sound pleasant. I mean, hiking sounds pleasant, but the extra weight and the weight of the world on your shoulders doesn't sound like that much fun. Where were you stationed at in Alaska? What was the major city you were by? Were you closer to Anchorage or closer to Fairbanks?
Fairbanks. We were up at Fort Wainwright, just a hand, I think maybe 150 miles. I'm trying to remember now. It's been too long. South of the Arctic Circle. You know,
yeah, I've actually been to Fairbanks. We flew up there for a couple of days, ended up going hiking in the Chena Mountain Trail, went to the hot springs and all that fun stuff, stayed at the quote unquote North Pole. There's a town in Alaska called North Pole. So I have that little feather in my cap, and those that know kind of laugh at it. Those that don't know are like, wow, you've been to the North Pole? Yes, just not the one you're thinking about.
I used to tell people that I lived about 20 miles north of the North Pole.
And what do they say?
They just kind of look at me. They're like, how does that work?
We actually floated above the North Pole in a magical city. Yeah. So Tribe and Purpose is it fair to say that it's an organization where people, it's a coaching organization, then you have a community that's built around that?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. So we help business leaders really get their juice going. You know, when you start your business, you get all this excitement. And I like to refer to it as, you know, the kitchen table size business, because everybody's sitting around the little table and you got this instant karma and communication. It's everything is flowing and everybody's excited and there's all this energy. And then the business grows and you start having success. You start bringing more people in. If you want to draw a line, it's usually at about 10 employees, not people that are, you know, functional direct bill, if you will, but 10 employees in that overhead sort of space that are costing you money. That's when things start to change, because now everybody's got an office. You're not looking right across the table at them. And you start to wonder, why am I doing this? Am I the only one who cares what's happening? Or you get that feeling like you want to open the door and step out on the shop floor and go, does anybody care if the freaking lights are on tomorrow morning? Does anybody in here really care? Do you give a shit? Is anybody? You know, and you want to yell that out because you start getting frustrated because, like, is he really doing what he said he's going to do? Yeah, he wants to work from home. He's just trying to get over on me. And he's this and this. And this kind of passive aggressive attitude starts happening. And then another indicator of it is your best people start to leave, because now they're starting to wonder, well, what's my value here? You know, we're just going through the same old motions that we did before. We do this and we do it again. And then, you know, Otis yells at us and then we change it. And then he throws something else out and we don't even know where we're going to be. What am I going to do? And what's happened is nobody has an idea or vision for the future. And particularly the founder has lost that love of what he's done, what he's created, he or she's created. And they no longer have a vision for the future for themselves, let alone the business. And that's what we help them start to figure out. Is okay, well, where do you want to be? Who do you want to be? What do you want to be doing? And once they start to figure it out for themselves, we start to align the business with that same thing. One of the best examples is one of my clients, we had a conversation about this fairly early on in our agreement. You know, he came to this realization that, holy crap, I don't want to be the COO in 5 years. I want to be chairman of the board of an employee-owned company. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got kids. I want to spend time with my kids, and I want to do this, and I want to do that. I want to be able to go skiing and not have to worry about something, you know, what something happened in the shop. I want to take my kids out fishing. I want to, you know, all these sort of things. I want to spend that one-on-one time with my kids, focused on them. And that realization has helped him change how he's growing his business right now. You know, who he's hiring his replacement. You know, when you start thinking about that, it's a heck of a lot better to start thinking about who that's going to be, whether it's somebody in the team or what that person looks like that's not in the team yet, and start looking for them now, as opposed to, God, this job sucks. Let's sell. You know, and just, I want the exit strategy. I'm out. I might put a for sale sign out there. You know, those are never good situations.
They business really for sale, $1, please alleviate me of all these problems.
Just relieve me of this job. Yeah.
Yeah. So it sounds like you find people that have built something, about 10 employees at least, and the founder starts questioning everyone else's care factor. The loyalty comes into question, and you start having this attrition. People are heading for the exits. I know a lot of organizations that run this way, a lot of nonprofits, high attrition rate. And the thing that I see that's missing in organizations like this is the founder/leaders of the organization stop stumping for vision, opportunity, and hope every day. If you're the leader and you're not leadership by walking around, like if you're not around the people and you're not sharing the vision, the hope, the opportunity that they have every day, if you leave that at the HR room or the hiring process, when they come in, they say, oh, this is a great opportunity. And then you beat on them every day for the next couple of years. And you never mention the opportunity, the vision, how you fit into it, all those things. And that's something that we had in the military, right? When you get ready to go do a bigger mission, an action or whatever insertion, like you go over the mission, you go over the planning, you go over the value that each team member has to the overall objective. And that's something that we do in the military quite frequently. But do you see this that is missing in the business world, in the nonprofit world?
Oh, 100%. It's that, you know, so what is it we're trying to achieve? What problem are we trying to solve? Particularly when you think in that nonprofit sense, whether it's homeless veterans, mental health crisis, you name it, whatever it is. You get excited about it and you start it and everybody's excited. It's just, I mean, a nonprofit is nothing more than a business that does something different with the money, right? You start to get into it and you start to get into that day to day and you're starting to attack the problem. And then it just becomes mundane. And what happens is you start bringing people in and they're all excited initially about we're going to solve this problem. And they get disheartened because a lot of these problems you can never solve. You can mitigate them. You can help a few people. But if the leadership of that organization, of that nonprofit, is not, like you said, selling hope every day. And here's the real trick. It's not selling the hope of solving the problem. It's selling the hope of the organization and understanding how that individual's hope aligns with the organization's hope. That's how you keep people in there. When they understand that, one, they're significant and their actions are value-added and have significant contribution to the success of the organization, and the leadership understands what their hopes and dreams are and how their hopes and dreams align with the organization's hopes and dreams, then you're starting to get teamwork, because then my Maslow's hierarchy of needs, those top two in the pyramid are starting to be fulfilled. And I'm happy to be there. I'm not, holy crap, it's only 10 and I got another hour and a half before I can take lunch. You know, we've all had those days, right?
Oh, absolutely. It's interesting when you start at an organization, especially if you don't have any experience, if you're starting at quote unquote, the bottom or the entry level of whatever organization you're coming into, you are doing most likely the scut work. You're taking out the trash, you're sweeping floors, you're running the mailroom, you're doing this, that, and the other. But those tasks, although very low level tasks, they're not, you don't need higher level thinking to sweep the floor. You're not contemplating existence of whatever when you're cleaning up after people. Those things allow the function of the rest of an organization that does have the mission. Hey, Jimmy, I know you're working the mailroom this year. I know we're a nonprofit and you're just mail coming in, mail going out, but here's the deal. You are the lifeline that we have from us to the volunteers and the donors and the public that showcases who we are, what we do every day, and the impact that these individuals are having, not only personally, but for the people that we're trying to help and the community. If it wasn't for you, Jimmy, keeping this mail running, we wouldn't be able to do that. And I really appreciate it. What did that take me? Like 20 seconds to bring home the vision of what we do, how that, even though it doesn't seem like that big of a task, how the impact that has on the people, the organization, the donors, the volunteers, and the community. 20 seconds is all that took. And now Jimmy is reinvigorated, even though he knows doing the mailroom stuff is not that great. It's not glamorous. It's not like the letters are going to stop coming, right? It's a never-ending stream of stuff coming his way that he has to deal with. But he understands how he fits into the organization's vision and what that can do, not only for him, but how it can affect the world around him.
Oh, 100%. That makes all the difference in the world. The story I always use is about the janitor in the hospital. It's the same thing. You know, if the janitor understands that his job, by keeping the floors clean and the room clean and disinfected, then their clients, the patients, can get healthy quicker and get home to heal sooner. So now the janitor understands his piece, however small it may seem to the outside, he understands that his piece has value to accomplishment of the mission and success of the organization, just like Jimmy in the mailroom. Same thing.
The old adage I used to use was about someone laying bricks, right? Hey, little kid walking around, going to and from school, and there's this new house being built or new something being built. And he walks with the first guy. He's like, hey, mister, what are you doing? He's like, what's it look like I'm doing? I'm laying bricks, right? The very low level view of what he's doing. He walks up to the next guy. He's like, hey, mister, what are you doing? He's like, oh, can't you see? I'm constructing a wall, right? He's doing the same job as the first guy, but he has a little bit bigger vision, right? And then he gets up to the third guy. He's like, hey, mister, what are you doing? Oh, we're building a church for the kingdom of God, who has the full vision of doing the exact same task. It's not that I'm just podcasting. I'm recording a conversation with, you know, me and Otis, right? We're doing that, but we're creating these conversations in a place where we can bring together thought leaders from the nonprofit world, the business world, consultants and leadership, so we can have the conversations that really make an impact in your organization, and you can implement this stuff today. That's a far bigger mission than just, hey, Otis, man, how you doing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. It brings meaning. And you know, the other piece of that is, so it's not just the people on the team, Jimmy in the mailroom, Bob the janitor, even the upper level, the senior management, they've got to have that same thing to include you as the founder, you know, the CEO, whatever, you know, the guy who's leading the charge. You've got to see that too, because there's plenty of days where you're in the suck and it just ain't a lot of fun, but you've got to see that dealing with the suck in this moment, in this day, is justification for what we will achieve, creating that hope and that vision.
Yeah, absolutely. For those non-military, non-veterans listening to this, what the suck is the assumption that everyone knows how terrible the thing is that you have to do, but you know you have to do it. So there's a mantra called embracing the suck, or embrace the suck, that everyone knows, although it's not the best, the brightest, the funnest, the whatever, right? Miserable conditions, especially for military deployed, that you know you need to embrace it, go through it together. And then when you get through it, you can look back with nostalgia, knowing that you did so as a team, even though it clearly sucked.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, and I'll just say real quick on that. Special Forces going through, you know, my Green Beret training, the selection and assessment. I knew that it would suck. I trained my ass off for it, but I don't care how much training you got, you still know it's going to suck. But you know what's at the other end of that, successfully getting through that, because you had hope, you had a vision for what you were going through, and you knew that you could go through whatever it was to achieve how bad you wanted it, what you wanted. And that shows you how bad you want.
Yeah, I think that might be something that not all, but a lot of civilians are missing, is understanding that the thing that you're going through is going to be terrible. I had the same thing going through flight school. I knew how hard it was going to be. I knew I was going to have to study my tail off. I knew that I was going to have to go through SEER school. You did SEER school? Yeah. We know just how awful it's going to be, but we also understand how necessary it is in order to reach that thing you're trying to achieve. There's not a lot of people that can say that they're Green Berets. There's not a lot of people out there that can say they're aviators or flight officers. There's just not. You can find them, right? You can get the right room and everyone's one. But in the vast majority of rooms, you're the only one if you're that person. What it takes to get through that, understanding the fortitude, the resilience, the dedication of what it's going to be to get through that level of whatever. I can withstand anything if I know it's a certain period of time. If I know, hey, this is going to be 1 year of my life, it's going to be terrible, but I know I can get through it and do it, you can withstand just about anything. I knew SEER school was 14 days. I knew that it was going to be terrible, but I knew it was only 14 days long.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I love in that aspect, and I'm trying to think that there were some things that I did that you never knew. You knew the big picture, how long it was. That event in the big picture, you didn't know how long that was and how you had to be mentally prepared. Was it going to be 48 hours, 72, 96? Was it possibly going to be more than that? You never knew. And all you could do was continue to push through it with a vision and a hope and and the reality. So you're balancing the hope with the reality. And this is a little bit of stoicism. I'm thinking of Admiral Stockdale in his book, Thoughts of a Philosophical Fighter Pilot. And when he talks about the guys that survived, you know, in the Hanoi Hilton, they weren't the optimists and they weren't the pessimists. They were the realists. They were the guys who took it one day at a time and said, okay, I got through another day. Okay, I got through another day. And when you think about it in business, you know, the suck in business, you don't know how long it's going to be. How long is this period going to be? You know, you hear stories about various business folks selling something. Sarah Blakely, a great one with Spanx, and how she went to 27 different department stores before somebody agreed to let her display. And what if it had been 30 department stores? Would she have kept going? What if it had been 36? But it's that belief that you have that this is the right thing for me to do, no matter the pain and the effort that I've got to push through. I believe in what I'm doing. I believe, like in the nonprofit sense, I believe in solving that human crisis problem. And I believe we can do it. And we're going to push through all the boundaries, all the blocks, all the tough days to get those wins, to do that.
I fully agree. You talked about Sarah Blakely. There's also J.K. Rowling that got rejected from some like 200 publishing houses. I don't remember the number. Don't quote me on the number. Thomas Edison tried 800, 700 ways to make a light bulb. A light bulb was already invented, but there wasn't a commercially available, easily accessible light bulb. There was, you know, when like the first computers came out and they took up the whole basement of a city building in order to operate, you know, it doesn't have anywhere close to the capacity that we have now. There's a difference in the military of an operation or a training period that you know is going to be terrible, but you know it's limited. And comparing that to the complete uneventuality of a problem being solved, there's people that have dedicated their lives to disease, social problems, human suffering, that know they're going to dedicate their entire life to and know they might likely not ever solve it, but they're going to keep pushing forward. I think the Mars Society started either in the late 90s or the early 2000s. They've been going on 30 years, 25, 30 years of not yet getting to Mars. And some of them know without a doubt that they might not make it in their lifetime. Elon Musk says he wants to die on Mars, but not on the landing.
I'm glad he defined that.
Yeah. But I mean, that's the big thing, isn't it? Is understanding that it's not as simple as going to the grocery store. I am a grocery shopping hater. I don't know what it is about the grocery store. I don't know what it is. I go in there and I'm just upset that I have got to walk around this place. It's a mystery where anything is. I've got to load it into the cart. Then I've got to get to the checkout and I've got to unload it, to scan it, to reload it, to get it to the car, to unload it of the cart into the car. And then I've got to go home and unload it again to take it inside to then put it away. Like, it makes me angry. It makes me so angry. I don't know why, but it does. Maybe it's exactly how I just described it as why it makes me angry.
That is 100% why.
Yeah, like it's the worst.
Look at all these steps I got to do.
But I know that it's only a short time. So if I'm going to go and do it, I know I can go do it, get it done, you know, grump about it or whatever, but then it's over.
Then you get to eat.
Then I get to, yeah, oh yeah. Then you get to eat. Oh, yeah, eat what you kill. But then you usually get like Qdoba on the way home, and then you save your stuff that you bought for like the next night because you're already too tired from shopping. You talked about entrepreneurs, people starting a business, and are they creating a business or are they creating a job for themselves? Are they an owner or are they an owner operator? There's a difference. There's people out there right now shaking their head like, what are you talking about? There's people out there, whether you know it or not, that own businesses that don't ever go to the business. You think the owner of the local McDonald's franchise shows up every day, every week, every month, maybe once a quarter, maybe once every 6 months, just to make sure it hadn't burned down, but they're not there running the day to day. You can own without operating a business or a nonprofit. You can't really own a nonprofit, but you can do the things you have to do without being quote unquote present. You mentioned about hiring your replacement, which is one of the things that nonprofits do terribly. A lot of nonprofits I know are terrible at onboarding, terrible at training, terrible at keeping people up in the vision, the opportunity, and the hope. And then they wonder why they leave 18 months later, and now they've got to get someone new. Like, they never bring people on with the thought of those people working themselves out of a job, working their personal self out of a job, because they're bringing the people up specifically to take over roles to free up the time and capacity of the founder or the CEO.
Yeah. Well, if you're not being that leader, and part of being that leader, you know, we talked earlier about creating that hope and vision and understanding what your team members' hope and vision is. If you're in the business day in, day out, you don't have the time or frankly, the mental capacity to think about what's coming next. Where do we want to go? Well, how do we handle this? What if this? How can we prepare for this? What events are happening? What events can we create? All these sort of things that will make you more successful. You're not thinking about those. If you're doing the day-to-day, even 50% of the time doing day-to-day, you're doing a disservice to your organization and your team because you're down in it. Now, I got a caveat that when you're starting, guess what? You got to do the day-to-day. You got to be in it because you got to grow to that point where you can start to bring people in that take over some of those duties and responsibilities. And frankly, they should be experts in those areas, which makes it even better, right? If I'm taking care of the HR and payroll, and then I bring in somebody who's an HR payroll person. Holy crap. Look at that. Imagine that. Not only do I not have to do it anymore, but now it's even more efficient and effective. You know, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about. And you do that as you grow and become more successful. So yes, go back to our suck description. You got to go through the suck, but you got to go through the suck with the mind that how do I create that vision? How do I work myself out of the job that I'm doing right now? The guy who's turning the wrenches in the shop to where I can start to think about, well, what's next for the shop? Do we want to add different types of cars, different types of fixes? Do we want to open a new shop? Well, if I'm turning a wrench every single day, I can't think of those things. I can't vision them. Not only can I not envision them, but I can't even start to put things in place to accomplish that vision.
Yeah, when I look at these things from the point of view of my time as a sailor or as an officer, my time as an entrepreneur or a podcaster, my time in the nonprofit world, every time I do something the second time, right? You do something once, it's whatever, right? You got to figure out how to do it. You do this thing, right? The first things that I'm thinking about is, can I delegate this? Can I eliminate this? Does it need to be done? Can I automate this, or can I hire someone else to do this completely? If I am repeating tasks as a leader, is it mandated that I do so? Am I some mid-level, upper-level C-suite exec? Am I, you know, responsible to report to a board? Like, what is it that has me specifically as a leader, as a manager? Those are different things if you didn't know that. What has me repeating these things, and why am I the one doing it? Can I push down the responsibility to alleviate the bottleneck? Can I set up an IFTTT, if this, then that, or a Zap on Zapier, I don't know how to pronounce it. Can I eliminate this altogether? Like, what is this really, what is the function of this thing that I'm doing? Or can I get rid of it or hire it out and have someone else do it, like bring on an HR firm? If I'm repeating tasks, I've got to know why. Is that thing that I'm doing, do I have to do that because that is the, what is it called? The queen bee role. Have you heard about this? The queen bee role?
I've not heard that term, but I can imagine what it is.
It's in Clockwork by Mike Michalowicz, however you pronounce his name. He also did Profit First, but it's in Clockwork. He talks about the queen bee role, that if everyone is dedicated to that role, that thing that you're doing, that's the thing that keeps everything else running. That's the thing that makes everything else worth it, right? The queen bee in the beehive, she has one role, and that is to create more bees, right? And if she's not doing it, she dies off. Someone else steps up to take that role on, but that hive has to have that queen bee operating, doing the thing that the queen bee does. What is it in your organization, your business, your nonprofit, that's the queen bee role, that if it's not being done, does the whole thing fall apart? What is that thing that you have to dedicate your time to as a leader, and everyone else should have an eye on, that they're doing it for that role, that purpose, that thing? For some people, it's your mission. For some people, it's your vision. For some people, it's a specific part of something that gets done underneath the umbrella of mission or vision. What is that queen bee role? Are you dedicated to it? Is that where you're putting your time, energy, and effort? If that's the thing that has to get done, that's the lifeblood of the thing that you're doing, whatever it is, and you're doing a bunch of other stuff, what are the chances that you're going to grow? What are the chances that you're going to accomplish and complete your mission or your vision? How likely are you to end a homelessness if you're not focused on whatever that queen bee role is?
You have to know what that is. I mean, think of it in the sense of, you know, if you're doing these other jobs, whether it's because you don't trust your team to perform it, or you just haven't set yourself up in this way or built your business this way, then who's leading? You know, every time you're head down doing something, working in the business, to use that phrase, working down and in the business, who's leading the business going forward? Because if you're head down working in it, whatever that is, go back to the, you know, the auto shop, if you're turning the wrench, who's answering the phone? If you're turning the wrench, who's putting together, you know, the Facebook posts so that other people know about your shop? You know, all these sort of things. Who's doing the customer satisfaction? Who's doing this? Who's deciding who gets what day off? You know, because somebody's still got to do that. You know, who's managing the team if you're turning the wrench the whole time? So these are all, you know, those that I like that the queen bee, because you know what? You ain't making no more bees if you're turning the wrench. If you're going out collecting honey, you ain't making bees.
How did that change for you throughout your military career? It sounds like you started in the Guard, and got commissioned and went up, decided to be a Green Beret, and you made it through that up to Lieutenant Colonel. As you rise through the ranks, we understand this in the military inherently, but people that are not in the military, what does it mean, and how do your roles change as you climb through the ranks from becoming a junior officer to field grade and then becoming a lieutenant colonel? What does that purview look like? How does your role change?
Well, you get more responsibility. And what's interesting is you get more responsibility going up. The people that are directly under you have more responsibility also. So one of the great things about the military, it's all linear, right? I mean, you know exactly what you're going to do. You know what you have to do in order to make it get the promotion. And then when you get promoted, you know what's expected of you, because you've also had people that you can model after or model against, because there's also those people that you've seen that were above you as like, God, I never want to be like that dude. You know, you whisper to a buddy or a friend or somebody that works for you, just, if I ever do that, make sure you let me know, you know, sort of thing.
Slap me, please. Yeah.
And you have the positive and negative role models to establish who you are as you grow up in the military. The other thing, the great thing the military does is they send you to training. This is one of the things, the Army is pretty strict about this. It's not when you pin the rank on, but it's kind of in that time. So it's not exactly, but it's this break where they say, okay, you've done the job at that level for a period of time. We're going to pluck you out and drop you in a school, which really is a really interesting concept when you think about it, because it's a physical and mental break from the day to day, which allows you to shift. Okay, now when I go back, and I had the opportunity to go back to the same organization, you know, a couple of times, but in between, it allowed me to grow to that next level. Still learning lessons when you get there and things, but you come back at that next level and you look at it differently. That's impossible to do in business. I mean, some of the big corporates, they do those same sort of things, right? They have some training and things like that. And there's even a handful of organizations out there that still allow sabbaticals every couple of years. And think of those military schools, those next level leadership development schools, almost like a sabbatical. That's difficult to do.
It's a little different in the Navy, because we always do schools between commands. We know very rare, there's a couple of positions like aviation safety officer, legal officer. There's a couple of positions in there where they pull you out during the tour to go to a couple of weeks school. But largely you have your primary training. If I look at officership, your junior officers, your 01 to 03, they're in the business of doing, right? They're out there, they're fighting, they're doing the thing. So for me, I went to flight school, got my wings, went to the squadron to do the business of whatever needed to be done, leading the people as a mission commander, the things that need to be done. After that, it's my job to then teach the next generation. So I had a thing of doing. So within that short 3 years, you have a year of learning, a year of doing, and a year of teaching. Within that first 3 years, you're learning those different roles as a junior officer. You go under your next command, which is you are in production, which means you are training the next generation of people to do the thing that you just did. Then there's the way that naval aviation works is you end up doing a disassociated sea tour. You learn some other aspect of the Navy outside of your own little zone. I went to Bahrain for a year and learned how to operate and run the Fleet Command Center, the watch floor, Fifth Fleet in the Middle East, and learned. I went to a planning school in between, and then I was in charge of 50 watch standers, 12 task forces. We had drones, we had special forces guys, and we ran at the 3-star level, very high level. The next thing coming back would have been a department head. This would have been the field grade, the 04. You go from the doing, you have a little bit of doing, but you are more leading a department, making sure you hit the metrics that are required for needs of the command. This would be needs of the office, needs of the organization. And you're reporting to the head leader decision maker. When you leave from there, you would go on some kind of other staff tour at a higher level and then come back as an 05. This would be a commander or lieutenant colonel, and you're in charge of leading the entire organization. So you're not doing it all, but you are talking to those department heads and ensuring that they are on track for meeting the metrics of the things that they're responsible for. So when we look at an organization, it could be an entrepreneur, it could be a nonprofit, you have all these different levels of leadership. And if you are a person that goes up through the ranks, your purview is going to change and the things that you are responsible for change. If you come in at a certain level, whatever that job requires is what you're going to do. Everyone has things they're responsible for and person that they report to. Even at the nonprofit, if you're the CEO or the executive director, you still report to a board of directors. But understanding what's really within your purview, within your lane, within your responsibility, getting that done. And then the military always was about tracking and training. Everything we did was tracked and trained. Every event we did, event's probably the best word. For entrepreneurs, it might be a launch or it might be an opening. For nonprofits, it might be an event or a campaign or this and that. You do it and then you have an after action where you say, hey, what the heck happened? What did we learn? What do we got to know for next time to make this easier? And I feel like nonprofits are missing the boat on that. They do something, they reach a goal, they take the next whatever amount of time off, they just kind of exhale, and then they get right back into doing the business how they've always done it. And they don't always seem to learn from the things that they have done.
That's a really good point. Matter of fact, I was talking with a client about that last week, you know, an event they had in the previous month. And the fact that they know better, because several of them are veterans, they have yet to do their after action report. You know, we're coming up on 6 weeks. You're gonna get together and talk about, you know, an event, fairly significant, costly event that your organization performed upper level, and you're waiting 6 weeks to discuss how that went and how to do it better next time.
Next work day, people. Next work day.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're celebrating. Right. Good job. High fiving. What did we learn? The thing that you're in charge of, what went well, what sucked, and how can we set it up better for next time?
So the way we always did, we did it in two steps. You do the hot wash. So basically, as soon as you get off the aircraft, you sit down and you do an immediate debrief on the op. And go through everything. And sometimes we'd even have outside sources come in and walk us through the debrief. And it's right there. And what's great about that is all the emotions are still there, still very emotional, still very raw. And it's a really great way to capture some things in a different aspect. So that's why we call it a hot wash, because of the emotions. That's one of the reasons, plus the prop wash. But those emotions are still very raw. So that's a really powerful place. And then come back 24 hours, you know, after you've had something to eat, showered, cleaned up, got a little rest, things have settled down. So now the emotions are back down. So now we're a little bit more objective in how we see things. And we can start to say, okay, I understand why Bob said that last night and really why he thought what we did, what he was trying to get us to do, you know, 3 days ago made sense in that moment. So we did it that way. We did those in a facilitated way where we would have somebody that would kind of lead us through it in phase one, talk about this, phase two, you break it down in these parts and pieces. And that's where you really get it. But here's the critical thing. Man, I call out, you know, my service. Well, I'm always hoping. I don't have any data to know whether or not it's gotten any better. But the biggest thing that we did in the Army is after that, and we spent all this time writing it up, putting in a beautiful document, it goes up the chain, gets approved and all that stuff. Then it goes into a safe and stays there.
And never gets implemented.
Yeah, it never becomes a lesson learned.
Yeah.
It's only a report. And that's... for anybody out there in business world, if you do these three steps, you do the hot wash, you do the more formal go through it all after you've calmed down, but then you got to make that stuff a lesson learned. And I'm not talking about the stuff you screwed up. I'm talking about the stuff you did right too, because you know what? What do we all want to do? We all want to focus on how we screwed it all up and the negative. But you know what? You did a lot right too. You may have only gotten one part of one thing right, but why not build on that? Make sure you're going to do that part right again.
That's the was it World War One lesson for reinforcing an airplane? One come back with all the holes in it, and like, oh, we should reinforce all the places that have holes. Nuh-uh, we're going to reinforce all the places that are left because those are the critical points of the aircraft. They're going to keep it flying. And we had a huge turnaround in World War II. We weren't able to keep more airplanes and all that fun stuff. So you have the event. You get the emotional hot wash. You get the logical feedback, turn it into lessons learned. Then you actually take that feedback and implement it into the training cycle and the training loop to prevent you from learning the lesson a second time. I have a young protege, Alan, who helps me with audiograms and a few different things for the podcast. My daughter's best friend growing up lives here in the neighborhood, which is great. He has an old AMC Rambler, and he's got a fancy 350 in it. And he has a lot of fun with it, as young guys with cars often do. He called me. His car broke down. He's right outside the house. He's the same neighborhood. He's like, I need help. So me and my son run out, my son Cole, and we go help him push the car into my driveway. And he's back there, and he ends up taking off the distributor, and he drops the new washer, the new gasket, into the hole where the distributor goes. For those of you that don't know what we're talking about, it like disappeared into the vastness that is into the engine, and void. Can't be there, creates lots of problems. He was hanging his head, and every time we took the distributor out, we couldn't get it put back in right away. We'd plug the hole up so you don't drop anything else in there. He ends up dropping this in there, and he's devastated. He's like, oh man, like I can't believe this. And I'm helping him fish it out. We finally get it out, and it's like, you know, it's not the fact that you had the problem in the first place or drop this thing in there. That's not what's going to get you in the long run. And he kind of looks at me funny. He's like, what do you mean? Cause he's not feeling the best, right? He's down on himself. I was like, what'll really get you is the years that go by and you drop something else in there, knowing full well you already learned the lesson and you're going through the second time. That one's going to hit you way harder than making the mistake in the first place. So don't do that in your organization. Don't make the mistake of having a mistake, solving the problem, learning the lesson, and then not sharing that lesson with everyone else in the organization, everyone else that comes along following them. You see this in military aviation. Someone will run something into the hangar bay doors, these gigantic doors that are in the hangar bay. You're going to crunch something. It's going to happen. You're going to do this thing. You're going to do the lessons learned. Everyone's going to get briefed on it. And then what happens in the military is you have this changeover, right? So the people that it happened to, they're like, oh, I can't believe we didn't learn from the last time. They're going to train all the new people. Everyone there is going to be at a heightened place of, man, we can't have this happen again. Obviously, it costs a lot of money. It's a huge pain, all that stuff. And they will train those people. But the people that got trained, as people change out, they're not training that next generation coming in. And because they forgot to train the next people coming in, they're going to have to learn the lesson all over again, especially in a high turnover group like nonprofits. You are going to find, if you're there for long enough, you're going to have to keep relearning the same lessons. How long does that take? How much extra time is going to be spent if you have to relearn the lesson every 2 years because you didn't train them right in the first place? How much is that going to suck?
Yeah, and you said there's a problem with the nonprofits and this also, and then hiring and onboarding. I mean, that's what it boils down to, is how do you prepare your team to succeed? And how are you taking those lessons learned, teaching the immediate team, but then making it an enduring lesson learned in the process? You know, how are you implementing that and truly showing those people the next group, whether it's replacing somebody or you're growing because you're having more success because you learned some lessons, but how are you teaching them to make sure that they do that and have that growth and success? Because that's time and money, and that'll kill your business. I don't care what you do. If you're having to spend the time and money to repair that hangar door, you know, every 2 years, because now you got a different operator in there, and you didn't put it in the standard operating procedures for the train up, or you did the classic, well, it was in the SOP. How come you didn't read it? You said you read the SOP. Yeah, really? Really? This manual like this? When was that time in the hiring processes you gave me time to sit down and read that manual and practice it and make sure I understood it? Yeah.
So everything we're talking about right now is like a higher level organization. How does this look in lower level organizations? Somehow, some way, McDonald's, Burger King, all these fast food joints, Taco Bell, have figured out a way to create a C+, B- product. Let's not mix words here. Like, it's not that great. They run this thing, the whole operation. Essentially, you've got a cat herder, some manager in his mid-20s or early 30s, managing a bunch of teenagers, and you've got multi-billion and multi-trillion dollar corporations basically run on teenagers with no serviceable skills. They come in off the streets basically knowing nothing. They say, wash your hands. Here's how you assemble a hamburger. Try not to punch out the customers. Essentially, they're trained at this point. They're able to run multi-million dollar businesses based on the systems they have in place.
I'll just give you real quick, McDonald's. So my oldest son worked at McDonald's for, to see how bad a job really sucked. But he said, he was back in the grill area. There were pictures. It wasn't even words. Pictures. This is how you assemble a hamburger. Step one, this. Step two, this. Step three. Literally for illiterates working there. He said the training was like 15, 20 minutes. Follow the pictures. And that was basically what he did. Push the button to start the fries. Push the button when the fries are done. Take it out. Dump it here. The process has been created.
Well, there you go. So if you are going to onboard people and you're not going to spend the time to train them, you have to include pictures of how to do the things that they need to do if you want to be successful and you're not going to train your people.
Yeah. Yeah. In a sense, though, it's not the best training, but you're still training them. Here, follow these steps. I think it was our friend Dan. Dan was telling us about, the learning method. You teach them 80% and you let them learn, figure out the other 20%, right? I think that was something we talked about with Dan one time. There's something to be said for that. So do I flip the burgers to the right or to the left? Maybe that's the 20% for the McDonald's grill guy. I don't know.
Yeah, let them strive to figure out and close some of the gaps. Letting them learn the lesson is a huge part of that. If you are the sole answer for everything they need, they're going to be knocking on your door, calling you all day long. Let them be the solution to your problem. This has been a fantastic conversation, Otis. We talked about vision, opportunity, and hope, and how everyone in the organization, top to bottom, needs a refresher on that on a fairly regular basis, if not daily basis. We talked about it's a lot easier to get through the suck if it's got a time limit on it. And if it doesn't have a time limit on it, you have got to keep reapplying that motivation every day. Motivation's like soap. It's fantastic, but it's got to be reapplied. We talked about doing something more than once. How are you going to delegate that, eliminate that, automate that, or hire someone to take that over for you so you're not doing it time and time again? Make sure you're getting into your queen bee role so your organization is going to thrive and grow because you're focusing on the right thing. We also talked about the beauty of preparing your team to succeed with the after action report, getting the hot wash, the emotional feedback, doing the lesson to learn and getting the logical feedback, actually getting that implemented. The critical point here is to actually give the feedback, provide updated procedures, and provide the training to the personnel so they can do it right the next time. And then follow that all up with, there's people like Sarah Blakely at Spanx, J.K. Rowling, Thomas Edison, that had to go do this thing over and over and over and over and over again, and not losing any motivation, any steam, any energy to get their vision pushed forward. Otis, where can people find you?
Well, our website is tribe-purpose.com. And You know what? I'll throw out there. I write a weekly newsletter called Monday Moments. And if you go to tribe-purpose.com, there's a get started button. And you click that button, hit the newsletter. And reason I ask this is because it's a great way to start the week, because what I'm doing is I'm sharing my lessons from this week, next week, so that Monday morning when you open up that email, you go, okay, Otis did this or accomplished. It's not, you know, I screwed this up. Sometimes it is probably like 50-50. I'd like to say on the positive side, but it's also, hey, this, I thought about this, or I had this happen in my life, and this is how it applies and how you can move forward, so that you start your week off with that positive thought of, all right, well, let me kick it off. And, you know, it's just a great way to share what I've learned, my experiences with a larger group of people. I love doing it. And yeah, so Monday Moments newsletter, and go to tribe-purpose.com.
Hey, thanks, Otis, so much for being my guest today. You can check out his podcast, Cam and Otis Show. You can search for Travis, and you'll see where I've been a guest on his show. Now he's been a guest on my show. If you love these podcast things, check out nonprofitarchitect.org/resources. Check out our ultimate podcast guide. Find out how you can get your own show started and have great conversations like the one you heard today.
You've been listening to The Nonprofit Architect. To listen to all our past shows, visit http://nonprofitarchitect.org. And be sure to subscribe, rate, and review our show. Thank you.